Okay, hello everyone. Thank you for joining us this afternoon at this book event to celebrate the publication of To Be a Jewish State, Zionism as the New Judaism, authored by our own Professor Yaakov Yadgar and published by New York University Press. Our discussion today will focus on the relationship between the five chapters of the book. The chapters can be read independently of one another. Nevertheless, integrating them results in a unique and comprehensive analysis, which is our goal this afternoon. The book opens with a question, and I'm quoting, "What does it mean for Israel to be a Jewish state? What is Zionism in relation to Judaism?" End of quote. While this fundamental question runs throughout the book, Yaakov reminds us that it is not just about Israel itself, but about nationalism in a broader context. Consequently, Yaakov teaches us that the state of Israel should not be seen as a particular case, but rather as an exception that offers the prospect of proving the rule. The distinction between a state of the Jews and a Jewish state, which stands at the center of the chapter 1, carries some significant implications. The first is the state of the Jews, a sovereign entity made up of Jews. As a result, this option requires the Jewish state to be mindful of demographies, meaning it must prevent an imbalance between the Jewish majority and the non-Jewish Palestinian minority. Meanwhile, the Jewish state option establishes certain normative, ethical, and moral principles that align with what one might refer to as Jewish heritage. Through this juxtaposition, Yaakov initiates another essential debate. Who are the Jews? How is one defined as a Jew outside the context of European anti-Semitism? Does Jewishness have a subjective aspect in addition to its racial component? In other words, how does the Judaism of the Jewish state relate to the traditional or historical Jewish culture or heritage that it claims to represent? In the second chapter, Yaakov suggests framing the Zionist claim to Jewish identity as an act of supersessionism, a political theology of replacement, where Zionism is seen as taking over the role and place of historical traditional Judaism, framing the latter as anachronistic or even inauthentic. Nevertheless, the picture is much more complex, as Zionism both rebels against and subordinates the Jewish past, negating and appropriating it simultaneously. Most notably, this ambivalent replacement is evident in the theopolitics of a state, where sovereignty functions as a quasi-divine agent that both protects and completes the Jew. Israeli ambivalence toward the Jewish past is reflected in both its vision of the past and its vision of the future, or as Yaakov calls it in chapters 3 and 4, nostalgia and redemption. Through the politics of memory, which are always the politics of forgetting, the state agents of memory can formulate a proper supersessionist approach, or at least attempt to do so. However, these politics of memory, as part of the engagement with the negated Jewish past, allow the past to speak, or to put it another way, enable resistance and call to memory by counter-hegemonic groups, both Mizrahi Jews and Palestinians. Likewise, Zionist soteriology engages with pre-state traditions, reframing and appropriating them into the narrative of the sovereign state. A central concept of Zionism, and significantly religious Zionism, involves the secularization of key theological concepts, such as the temple, redemption, and the gathering of the exile, Kibbutz Galuyot. Consequently, the state of Israel embodies the fulfillment of the traditional yearning for Zion, rendering the entirety of Jewish history as Zionist, with the state of Israel representing the apex of that history. The state is viewed as the temple and the demonstration of sovereignty on the Temple Mount, and the entire region signifies redemption. The book's fifth and final chapter outlines, or rather calls for, Jewish criticism of Zionism, illustrating Leon Roth's writing on the subject. By concluding with Jewish criticism, Yaakov seems to be conveying something about his own position, a Jewish critic of Zionism, an intimate critic from within. Therefore, it seemed only natural to invite one of the most influential critics of Zionism who approaches criticism from a Jewish standpoint, a teacher, and for some a friend, to discuss the book with Yaakov and with us. Amnon Ras Krakotskin teaches at the Department of Jewish History at Ben-Gurion University of the Negev. He was a fellow at the Berlin Institute of Advanced Studies, I'm sorry not to say it in German, at the Katz Center for Advanced Judaic Studies in Philadelphia, a visiting professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and at the School for Advanced Studies in the Social Sciences in Paris. Among his many publications, The Censor, The Editor, and the Text, Catholic Censorship and Hebrew Literature in the 16th Century, published in the University of Pennsylvania Press in 2007, and Exil au Souverainté, published by La Fabrique in 2007. An English version of his recent book in Hebrew, Mishnah Consciousness, Biblical Consciousness, Suffered in Zionist Culture, will come out in Brandeis University Press next year. And for those of you, for some reason, who are not familiar with Yaakov, so Yaakov Yadgar is a Stanley Lewis Professor of Israel Studies here at Oxford and a fellow of St. Anne's College. His previous books include Sovereign Jews, published by State University of New York Press, 2017, and Israel's Jewish Identity Crisis, published by Cambridge University Press in 2020. Please join me in welcoming both Professor Yadgar and Professor Ras Krakotskin.
Thank you.
Do we start? All right.
You start.
No. Okay, so I will say a few words. The idea that we had in mind was after this wonderful presentation of Davidi of the entire book and each chapter to discuss some of the chapters at least separately, because the book is full of insights and it is impossible to summarize it. And as you could see, the questions are really questions, so it's better to try to think about it, and I'm sure that we will not complete this conversation as the book in front of us really open. It proposes amazing new insight, but open new questions to deal with. For me, it's a real honor, and I'm very glad of the opportunity to come here and to participate in this celebration, because Yaakov was always a source of inspiration, and I worked thinking about his insights since his first stages, when he worked about internal Israeli issues, mainly about traditionalism and the critique of what is secular in Israel. In fact, in the last years, we became much more friends and we partners for a continuous conversation. I think that since he left to Oxford, our conversation started when he had to leave in order to continue it. But meanwhile, he published three books that this is the third of them. I wouldn't call it a trilogy because I'm sure it's not the last. They deal with the uniqueness of what he called in the first of these volumes, sovereign Jews. What sovereignty is doing here? What is the role of sovereignty in the formation of the Jews? Instead of seeing sovereignty as simply a solution or a problem, it is something else that he is doing here. And since then, he really deals in all these three volumes. I will keep only speaking about this one, but it is sometimes impossible. During all these volumes about the real tension between Judaism and Israel, I wouldn't say even Zionism here, but the fact that Judaism and Israel have this Zionism there also tells us about the issue. And indeed, the first question that was raised already in the introduction was the question of exceptionality. And as Yaakov says, both supporters of Israel and its opponents insist sometimes of his exceptionality, and he insists of thinking about it within the framework of nationalism, nation state, and to see the cases in which we learn from other cases about Israel. But at the same time, after declaring it, the question that the book also raised all the time, the question of exceptionality when you talk about Israel. What is it, the state of Israel? And we are talking now, particularly, so Yaakov insists, I'm talking about a state. I'm talking about a nation that was created through this state. And this is one of the questions that we will deal. Who is the Jewish people? Who is the nation of the nation state? What? This is a question that hardly can be found any equivalence elsewhere. Who is the nation? And there is a distinction between different aspects. I mentioned them, and I go back to the, there is the traditional people of Israel, which is also not simply ethnic, but theological term. The people of Israel, the people of God. It never appears as the people of Israel. It's Israel Amo, his people. Yes, it's people. And there is the Jewish people. This invention of the 19th century, when great Jewish thinkers and rabbis wrote, thought about Israel in the 18th century even, they still didn't have a Jewish people. It turned the Jewish people were emerged as part of being, of the Jews being a question. And again, the question of exceptionality raises here, because it is always the Jewish question that accompanies the rise of nationalism in Europe. And the third is the Israeli nation, the Israeli Jewish nation, which is not identical with the Jewish people. It's just different. And it is a nation about, according to all aspects of nationalism, yes? And its diaspora, maybe in order to clarify it, it's not the Jewish diaspora, it's the Israeli diaspora, yes? Those who wake up in the morning and open the news site from Israel and want to know what happened yesterday in the soccer game, etc., etc. And they have their own language, and they speak Hebrew. And they speak the new Hebrew. So the question is indeed, what is Israel when, yet another thing, and here in Oxford perhaps even more, when I come here and I think, okay, there is Israel studies, but it is the study of ancient Israel, and what is the connection, and can you speak about Israel without Christian Zionism, and can when we speak about nationalism, I think about my colleague Ethan Bar Yosef, who wrote his dissertation here, who studied in Oxford and published his book about England and the Holy Land in the 19th century in Oxford University Press many years ago, I don't remember, but who deals about the interrelation. So nationalism itself cannot, you can think about nationalism without the Bible, which for some makes the Jewish acceptance of the Bible as trivial. That's there. Yeah. But in fact, as we know, it makes it more complicated because Judaism is not the Bible. But maybe we will talk about it when we talk about supersessionism.
First of all, thank you for coming. Thank you for the introduction. Thank you, Lono, for doing this. I think the distinction between the particular and the universal, the case and the script that it plays out, is essential for understanding the case at hand and the wider framework. It goes without saying that we live in an era which I would describe as a resurgent nation-statism. If you want to understand at least part of what, you know, the first quarter of the 21st century is about, I think it's impossible to ignore that it is a resurgent nation-statism in which, again, you could see Israel sometimes playing out a script or a move within a script that other nations, other states just follow later, not because Israel sets an example, only because they all play the same script. And on this level, I'm very happy to unsettle those who would want to study Israel as a unique and unprecedented and standing in it, you know, in itself, for itself, case. It is not. There are many similarities in the way that the underlying script plays itself. And just to give one example, you mentioned this complicated relationship between the state and the nation. One author that I don't mention in the book, a work that I read after completing the book, is a series of lectures by Pierre Bourdieu on the state. He gave in the Collège de France, and I haven't read it before writing the book. I should have, and I haven't. And one of the first things that this French sociologist speaking to his audience in the Collège de France has to stress and highlight is that it's a myth to think that the society precedes the state. The state creates the society. So that's on the universal level. And yes, and there is much to be said about how the history of the Zionist enterprise, which culminates in the establishment of the State of Israel, it's a history that starts with an idea, developed into an enterprise, a political project, and culminates in a state which then later, afterwards, receives its nation, which it builds, or it receives its population, which it builds as a nation. Having said that, it's very important to also unsettle those who do not see the uniqueness of the Jewishness of the playing out of those scripts. There is no other state in the world that sees itself as a state of the Jews, as a Jewish state. There is no other state that sees itself as committed to adapting, interpreting, as any script demands, this nation-statist logic into the history of Jews or the nation-statism of Jews or whatever. So it finds itself forced into a discussion with a claim to Judaism that some of its founders didn't really want to have. They thought of themselves as having overcome Judaism. I find this tension to be essential for understanding the State of Israel, and I hope that when we get to the, what I have to say more normatively in the conclusion, we can see how the Jewish case also sheds light on what other states, other nation states, can think of themselves as a way to overcome some of the maladies of this nation statism.
Yeah, the last sentence I will, yes. I will more than agree, even because I even dare to insist that yes. You can't think about Israel without thinking of the rule, but it is still the exception of the rule when you say that there is no other Jewish state, yes. But the state, because the state itself was formed through biblical images, yes?
Yes.
Hobbes, Leviathan.
Yes.
Yes? When the Bible is considered as so crucial, I mean, to think about it, I do agree, and perhaps we will come to it immediately when we talk about supersessionism.
Yes.
How to it is impossible to criticize Israel without working on the rule itself. But that's the way I see it. I'm not,
Another thing that I learned recently, and this was from Nono himself, which I haven't developed fully in the book, which obviously sheds light on this discussion, is that when we do describe when we refer to Jewish identity or Jewish peoplehood or Jewish collectivity, what is being formed in Israel as the Jewish people or Judaism or Jewishness, and what is being formed or viewed as Judaism and Jewishness outside of Israel, are more and more two distinct features. And I would like you to because I don't want to rephrase you, how do you see this playing out with relation to sovereignty? The Israeli Judaism, the Israeli Jewishness.
No, Let's wait with it. Okay. Let leave me alone for a minute.
Fair enough.
No, you don't want me to start speaking about it. Okay. There is enough to say here yet. But of course, it continues with the conversation because we don't want we're still in the introduction of the book, yes? We're still dealing with the introduction, with the question it raises, and then you come with the first introduction, the first chapter that makes it that answer your question, maybe the distinction between Jewish state and Jews state.
Yes,
what is the Jewish state and the Jew state, which maybe you want to elaborate on it a little bit.
So, first of all, and I think some of this should be rather trivial and obvious, but at the same time, when you start poking at it, you see that it's much more complicated than might seem at first sight. And writing this chapter has been an interesting exercise of trying to explicate some that is taken for granted, and then the very exercise of just mentioning it can be sometimes unsettling and sometimes, again, sound a little bit... So what are you trying to say that is not already discussed before? My argument basically is that there are two political visions that are entailed in different understanding of Jewish identity. There is what I would call a biological or demographic or ethnic or racial or whatever you want to describe it. There is a sense that the Jew, and the term would be the Jew, a Jew, right, precedes anything that is to be considered as Jewish creations, Jewish tradition, Jewish history. To be a Jew is a matter of the accident of birth. So the politics that emerges from that kind of politics is what, again, we have to give the credit to the teacher sitting here. Nono has, when I was just a young student, already phrased as this vision of Israel as a Jewish and demographic state. It's a state that is obsessed about the issue of the necessity imbalance between a majority of Jews and a minority of non-Jews. It's a politics that is enabled by this majoritarian notion, in which context anything that this group can do would be considered Jewish. I think if considered against the background of Jewish history, that's a complete novelty and some would say even a heresy of the concept of Jewishness. In any event, this has been the rallying cry of liberal secular Zionism. This is where it really gets interesting to see that it is the left, the liberal, the small in Israel that adheres to this demographic anxiety more than any other party in the group. There's an alternative view, which in the background of the Zionist idea we can identify with Ahad Ha'am, not a non-Zionist, not an anti-Zionist in any way. Not the non-secularist, a secularist through and through in his own self-identity, but a view that sees Jewishness as preceding this, or Judaism, or Jewish history, as preceding this accident of birth. Anyone can become Jewish. It doesn't have to do with blood. This accident of birth might enable you better access to it through education or through habitus, if you want to stick to Bourdieu. But what's essential here is that Judaism is a teaching. This is what the meaning of Torah is. Anyone can learn this teaching. And the matter of race or blood or ethnicity is completely secondary. But it is a judgmental. It's a normative view. You can say on something, this is Jewish, this is not Jewish. A politics derived from this view would demand of the state to adhere to a series of, well, normative callings. Now, to add to that, I would insist, yes, that there is another level which I do not attend to in the chapter, which is what you mentioned in your other work, that the very notion of Jewishness itself is read differently within the political context of a nation state and what the nation state called its diaspora, the Jewish diaspora.
Yeah. Well, I will continue in a few sentences again. Okay, so you go, clarified, you go back to two founders of Zionism, Herzl and Ahad Ha'am.
Yes.
Herzl, political Zionism, the question is the enemy.
Yes.
What makes the Jews a nation is the enemy. What made it also another aspect of exceptionality after the Holocaust. This is anti-Semitism. And interestingly, when Shabtai Betzvi, unknown author, wrote a book that was immediately suppressed in Israel, about Zionist attitudes, Zionist work, attempts even, and world Jewry during the Nazi period, he called it post-Ugandan, the post-Ugandan Zionism and its attitude towards the Jews. In other words, that for him, the abandonment of Herzl's view, that this is the issue, this is post-Uganda. Uganda was the case when the British Empire offered the Jews, allegedly offered, another solution in Africa, and the Zionists, Herzl supported it, but it was totally refused by the Zionist Congress and led to the immigration of the left-wing Zionists to Palestine. And this is also interesting because it was the left-wing who insisted there is no Zionism but in Zion, in the land of Israel. It's not the issue. If we think about it today, it tends to be the only way Israeli secular have to define themselves and their link to Judaism. They were Judaism as a tradition is not part of their world. Auschwitz and its commemoration is crucial aspect in their education. And it turned even this year, after October 7, because after all we have to remember, we are talking about a crisis that started before October 7. We are talking about a state that is in crisis, which we don't know how to identify in today because the entire world is in crisis. What does it mean only Israel with President Trump? But I think there was suddenly people expressed after 2 or 3 weeks after October 7, a kind of relief. We are united again.
Yes.
We have an enemy.
Yes.
We were had problems. They believed that it will solve the internal problems. Well, they were wrong, yes, but they believed, but it was declared again and again in TV programs, in many places. Yes, we have an enemy now. Now we are all united. Now we know what it is. That's it. It is over.
It might be also worth mentioning that the thing that they viewed as potentially tearing them apart on the eve of that holiday, right? It was the holiday season, were exactly issues of the very nature of the public sphere as a Jewish public sphere.
Totally. Exactly, because this is the Israel of the last 20 years, I think, since 2000, since the government of Ehud Barak. Since then, the idea is that there is no solution to the Palestinians. Don't forget, Palestinians are not a minority in the land. Yes, Palestinians are a minority among the citizens of Israel. Yes, it's important to remember the question of talking about Palestinians minority exclusively was part of this blindness. Of this total denial, in order to repeat this, what you call in the next chapter, nostalgia.
Yeah.
Yes, a kind of a white Jewish landscape. Yes, a type of it is a nostalgia. I say it immediately. That was a nostalgia to the utopias. Yes, it's not a nostalgia to any moment in the past. But it is a nostalgia to the Zionist utopias. There is nothing in between these nostalgias, and it's also, of course, a nostalgia of the Ashkenazi elite.
But before we go there, I want to make a point, and just to highlight something here. First, the point to make is that this book was written and finalized before the outbreak of the war.
Yeah,
and it doesn't even mention it in the preface. This is it's not about the war. But one thing that we've seen overtaking much of the public debate in Israel and specifically outside of Israel since the outbreak of the war, this talk of anti-Semitism and the problem of the conflation of anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism can be viewed as a necessary outcome of the construction of Jewish identity on the impetus of the other, of the hater, which Herzl, this is fascinating to see, and I mean, I write on this specifically in the book, when Herzl addresses the Zionist Congress and titles the lecture Judentum, so Judaism or Jewry, it's not exactly, I mean, the term would translate differently, he doesn't say anything about Judaism. He says, what unites us is the enemy.
Yeah.
He would agree with Sartre, who said later on, Jews don't have a history, don't have a territory, don't have a religion, they're basically outside of history. The politicization of them would bring them into history. Having a whole construction of identity that is fed by hatred needs the hatred to be sustained. And it's fascinating to see how this is sometimes, what kind of, how would I say, monsters it can create.
It is, yeah, okay. About anti-Semitism first.
Yes.
We have to deal with it now as a global question, yes. I mean, how we are dealing with Israel in a framework in which the post-USSR, let's say, or after the unification of, and the unification of Germany, anti-Semitism was distinguished from any other kind of racism and cannot be compared, tend to be one of the essential aspects of the West, and I don't know what will happen to it now with Trump and Gaza, between Trump and Gaza, I don't know, but it is there, and you mentioned it when you talked about Elad Lapidot's work against the anti-Semitism. Yes, there is anti-Semitism, there is anti-Semitism, and he proposed the anti-Semitism in order to normalize the discussion. Yes, in order to find for himself a place as a Jew.
Yes.
So we're going back to the question: I don't want to be within the mirror of Sartre, and the state of Israel is, of course, not as Norland, because Herzl's state was a European state. There is the Jewish thing there is a secularized synagogue. Yes, it's a Jewish church.
Yes
it's a Jewish. You can say that synagogue and church are identical elements, religion, nation. But of course, Herzl believed that the Israelis would speak German, not Hebrew. On the other hand, about the other opinion of Ahad Ha'am, who suggested Jewish culture, should remember that for religious thinkers, it was easier to identify with Herzl and not with Ahad Ha'am, with this problematic concept, what is Jewish culture? Which is almost identical with what is Jewish nation, that you go back is at the end. There is no Jewish national history. Yes, that's the point. I'm teaching in the Department of the History of the Jewish People something that does not exist. There is no, I mean, from our perspective, from the modern perspective, you can make such a field by comparing different Jewish communities that lived in the past and make sense of the comparative discussion. But it doesn't mean the Jews thought they have a history. Yes, the first Jewish history was not accidentally written by a Christian, Jacques Banage de Bouvel in the 18th century. So it's another aspect of the question.
So anti-Semitism is also an important angle through which to consider the very idea of supersessionism and then the complicated exercise of applying that concept to Zionism.
Yeah.
Because first it touches upon this very, again, unsettling and sometimes, completely controversial provocation of suggesting that Zionism feeds on anti-Semitic notions to build itself. But my whole exercise there is to highlight not necessarily this indebtedness to European anti-Jewish thinking, but more the indebtedness to the idea of overcoming Judaism. or as your work suggests, adopting the Christian ambivalence to Judaism. Yes.
And this is important. I mean, because this is also a debate with David Nirenberg's anti-Judaism, when he tried to discuss anti-Judaism as essential from antiquity, something essential including Islam and Christianity, and to take it out of the broader, obviously Christian discussion, which cannot be summarized as anti-Semitism. It will be meaningless, yes? So because then you say, okay, Christianity is identical to anti-Semitism, and I think, okay, this is a view you will hear in several Orthodox groups, but it doesn't lead us to any analytical understanding of anything.
And this, so supersessionism is a nice title to say the idea that one sees oneself, and this is a collective oneself, as not necessarily having replaced the other, but actually appropriated and making a claim to the authenticity of the other. So in the framework of Christian theology, it's the argument that the church would say, you know, like on first level would say the church has replaced Israel. Israel, the people of the Bible, the chosen nation. But then we would say, well, it's not really replaced because it has always been the authentic Israel. And those, you know, people who call themselves Jews or Israelites, whatever, they are just a mistake in a way. This framework of appropriation, enication, which Brian Klug has brilliantly demonstrated, first of all, shows us how difficult it is to come to terms with Christian Zionism. Because Christian Zionism is built on this premise of appropriation and negation. But then when you think who appropriates what from whom, the picture becomes much more complicated. First, there's the issue of the indebtedness of the Zionist enterprise from the get-go to non-Jewish thinkers who were calling to the restoration of the Jewish people in its land. Shalom Godman celebrates this as the necessity to expand our understanding of Zionism to include Christians or non-Jews within this framework. But then there's this problematic notion of negation. And if there's one work in the history of Israeli political culture and Zionism that anyone should read, and mostly read, is Nono's work on the negation of exile. The negation of exile not as an exercise of saying exile was where it didn't go well and we have to go and politicize ourselves. But exile is, well, I guess three different things which are negated in different ways, right? There's exile as being outside of the land, the physical dispersion, the diaspora, which is to be redeemed by the self in gathering of exile, not by waiting for God to bring us together. There's the political notion of exile, which Zionism, I think, highlights more than anything else. Exile as the status of lacking sovereignty, as being a minority among other people who rule us. So this is what drives the whole Herzlian project, right? We will rule ourselves. And then there's the deepest and most interesting and most theologically challenging of all, the notion of exile as what I would call in Hebrew ester panim, how would you call it in English? I'm not even sure. The theological understanding of it, which your work has expanded.
I will try to say something about exile. Yes, as indeed a topic that occupied me for the last, 40 years. You can't make progress when you talk about exile, because you always have to feel exile and you don't have to. You can solve the problem of what is exile, but I think it's crucial indeed for your discussion of supersession. I think that first of all we have to clarify, yes, what Yaakov observed is the Zionist attitude towards the Jews is following the Christian supersessionism, yes? There is the old Jew and the new Jew, the new emancipated, the new liberated Jew. There is the exilic Jew who is always stubborn, like in blind, like in the Christian perceptions of Jews in the Middle Ages. Yes, and the Zionist is something else. There is the old yeshuv in the land of Israel, the religious yeshuv, and they speak only about the Ashkenazi without mentioning the Sephardi larger community. And there is the new yeshuv or community, European, enlightened, liberated from the law. Because this is crucial for the secular Zionists, and liberated from tradition for everybody. Yes, so this is indeed one aspect of this brilliant understanding of Zionism in Christian terms. Yeah, you need it, and then you integrate into the West. You go back also to Herzl. It's not Jews as they are. Zionism didn't want to find a solution for the Jews as they are. She wanted to transform the Jews. She wanted to convert the Jews, I will insist. And now, what is Jewish understanding toward supersession? I mean, because supersession is indeed the Christian ambivalence towards the Jews. It is the truth that was replaced by a higher truth. Yes, there is a truth. That's the difference between, it's not total denial. You can't deny. It's a truth that was replaced, and there is an Old Testament and a new one, yes, like the old Jew and the new Jew, yes, the Paulinian Jew. For the Jews, the response was exile. That's exactly the notion of exile, and it was formed, and I'm following here, Israel Yaakov Yuval analysis of the Passover Haggadah, when he regards the Passover Haggadah as a counter-Christian text. So we used to see Christianity as coming from Judaism. Yuval tells us, no, it's not exactly. It's the Judaism that we know, the post-destruction Judaism, the post-Second Temple Judaism, the Judaism that we know was indeed established as a response to the catastrophe, to the destruction of the temple, but also in response to the new interpretation, the Easter. So instead of Easter, which is the manifestation of supersessionism, yes, the second revelation, the Jews insist, no, we are, our freedom is also here in exile. There is nothing. We are still in the same situation of the first revelation of the Sinai, of Sinai, and our exile is the manifestation of the world itself. And now, what's raised from your question now, from your analysis, when I take my language back to your book, is indeed, and also the question of exceptionality, is how to reestablish this counter-Jewish perception vis-a-vis not Christianity, but Zionism. Yeah. And these and the Jewish voices that emerge that cannot be suppressed because negation of exile was unsuccessful to a certain extent.
Yes. And I conclude the discussion in this chapter with the, I guess I'm doing the reader's work, and I ask, so what? So what's the merit of, you know, of this analysis? What do we gain from, you know, applying this perspective? And I think it all comes down to the question of Judaism. So what is the shape of Judaism in light of this dominance? And this is, again, something that Nono has said different times in different ways, and I just, you know, I'm happy to repeat that there is no way of understanding Judaism nowadays without referring to the state of Israel as claiming that Jewish identity. There are, I guess, those fringe groups that define their Jewishness as the negation of the state. But as you said, they're fringe and they don't necessarily offer something constructive. It's much more interesting to see two things, which for me are, a revelation of sorts. One is to see how secular Israeli identity is haunted by the fear of what Sholem, in the letter that Nono has discussed so brilliantly on Thursday, what Sholem described as the volcano of the theological, religious essence of this identity that they reclaim, or appropriate, I would say, not reclaim, appropriate. So this fear of Judaism within secular Israeli identity as a motivating force is just brilliant to see, whatever you, you know, whatever your judgment of it would be. The second is to see those who confront that appropriation, do not agree with it, but don't choose negation, but rather, I would say, adaptation, reinterpretation. The most the example I bring in the book is of the famous speech by Deri, Aryeh Deri, on the eve of the election when he was indicted, just about to go to jail or to trial, I don't know which one, right? This is 1996. 1999. In front of a big crowd in a sports stadium, claiming very forcefully, "We are the real Zionists. We do not negate Zionism, but our Zionism is the real one." And the way that, theologically speaking, the work of Rabbi Ovadia Yosef has dealt with this. So, in Sephardi Mizrahi synagogues in Israel, right? We don't say a blessing for the state. We don't elevate the state into a theological level, but we do pray for the safety of the soldiers because all of our kids are in service, basically.
Yeah. Maybe I can take it there. First of all, because you mentioned this Shas movement, Rabbi Ovadia and Aryeh Deri. I think that perhaps about Rabbi Ovadia we'll speak when we in. Come to this, your discussion about redemption in a minute, yes,
yes.
Because we follow the narrative.
We should.
We should.
Later, we should, yes.
We should.
Sorry.
What do you mean?
Time.
How much time do you have?
We have.
Oh, no, okay, you have to. We don't even have for your permission. Deri, in this speech, in front of thousands of ultra-Orthodox people, insisted to speak for 8 minutes about the need for equality to the Arab citizens of Israel. It was before 2000, before Barak. The liberals were occupied only with his corruption, but while arresting him, they prevented this ideal of someone who ultra-Orthodox, who insisted on taking responsibility as a minister, and in this this was something very different from ultra-Orthodox policies until today. The ultra-Orthodox, they govern they are in the government, but they are not ministers. I mean, ridiculous, yes. And Deri insisted on that, and that what I was shocked then is the need, because he talks to people, nobody, he will not get credit for it. But he insisted to speak on it as is part of his issue. It's part of, indeed, I think, what the legacy of Rebbe Ovadia, that on, let's say, religious, patriotic, I would not call him Zionist because perhaps he would not like it, yes, but patriotic considerations rejected the regard of Israel as redemption. And here we come to the other issue. Israel as the redemption embedded in Israel, and the way the perception of redemption leads to destruction. Yes, almost, yeah.
Yes. So the, you know, Shas and the phenomena that it represents, this often neglected majority of Jews within Israeli society who are not Ashkenazim and present a different approach to Zionism and to Jewish history and to Jewish tradition, also lead us to this issue of the Israeli and Jewish past. which is the which is discussed under the headline of nostalgia. One of the fascinating features of Israeli identity is that it has no history prior to 1948. There's no land of Israel, or Palestinian, if you would like to call, history to which that identity makes a claim. Notice that latest book on Safed, for example, shows this brilliant history, the brilliance of history of 16th century Safed and relevant other eras surrounding it, which is completely ignored by this kind of identity. It makes sense if you consider the supersessionist view. If you have overcome an identity, you don't make a claim to its history. So Jewish history is a problem because it's an exilic history. It's a history of religion. It's if you follow many of the Hegelian Zionists, it is not history. Jews were outside of history. Eretz Israel or Palestine history. Palestine is the country. Is not available. And at the same time, you see yourself as committed to the nationalist worldview that you have finally arrived home. While this entailed emigration, and uprooting and resettling, this creates a fascinating tension, and it's a very helpful key to use to understand Israeli identity, to consider which are the nostalgias. Any society has nostalgias. What is it that Israelis are yearn from, or what is it that different groups within Israeli society yearn for? And this distinction between an Ashkenazi nostalgia to the good old land of Israel, which is encapsulated in a soundscape, in a vision of pre-state Palestine or Eretz Israel, land of Israel territory, devoid of the two others, devoid of Palestinians and devoid of Mizrahim, where everything was wonderful and great, so the nostalgia says, contrasted with Mizrahi nostalgias, first of Ovadia Yosef, if you mentioned it, Al-Achzir Atara Yoshna, with the returning of its crown to the glory. Famously, this can be read differently, and apparently Ovadia Yosef, from what I read, had different ideas, but obviously his audience read it as to mean, we Sephardim, we Mizrahim, had a glorious history to which you want to return. Not in Israel, not in Palestine, among other nations. And what Avishai Margalit, whom I used to move the discussion forward, describes as a negative nostalgia of Mizrahim, who says, you know, we want to go back to the good old times in Arab countries before you Ashkenazim subjugated us into this. It's interesting to see how these two nostalgias, again, they are nostalgias, they're not historical constructs. We can't put them into, you know, under the scalpel of historical analysis or even political analysis, but as nostalgias, they present two contradictory horizons for Israeli society. One eliminatory, wanting to be alone, separate, and pure from others, and the other hoping for conviviencia, for living together in a shared society of sorts.
Yeah, but unfortunately,
yeah,
it almost disappeared. Yes, and the elimination aspect of Israeli policies tend to be growing more and more. Yes, so I think that we are coming. It is also the moment in which it is clear that you can't speak about Israel without speaking about Palestine, because otherwise you go to your last chapter,
yes,
to the Temple Mount, yeah, yes, to the Temple Mount, and you can think. And about exile, and this is indeed the distinction between religious Zionism,
yes,
generally, although there is a debate there, because many, yes, many extremists also refuse to go to the Temple Mount, yes, for their own reasons, but without the theological depth or that you will find in this attitude. Yes, they simply refuse, but they want sovereignty all over the land, including the Temple Mount itself, denying any denying Palestinians existence, and unfortunately, this nostalgia to the Arab-Jewish past was replaced by retelling the history of Jews in Muslim lands as history of persecution. I mean, as the lacrimose,
yes.
According to the lacrimose perception,
yes.
of Sarah Baron's famous phrase of against the lacrimose approach to Jewish history. Jewish history is not lacrimose. Interestingly, it was written 100 years ago,
yes.
Sarah Baron. Interestingly, it turned to be again a lacrimosian, lacrimosian history of the Arabs and the need of the Mizrahi to distinguish themselves from the Palestinians, because it's not the two others of Israel.
Yes. Yeah.
You can't talk about Mizrahim and Palestine, because as you say, as you show in this chapter, I think, indeed the difference between those who should be integrated through the denial of their culture, the Mizrahim, and those who are permanently excluded,
yes.
and from the history of the land, yes, the Palestinians. So, and still, it is this complicated Mizrahi attitude today that can bring us back to,
yes.
to this, what you mentioned about the celebration, the Rabbi Ovadia Yosef,
yes.
understanding, and this is important because Zionism accept, in fact, the perception of Zionism as redemption,
yes.
and that what leads,
yes.
to the deterioration, to the extreme even, because what you show in this chapter is that as long as you see the entire country as liberated, the attitude to the Temple Mountain to be stronger even, yes, and the demand to raise, namely, to destroy the current mosque, or to destroy Haram Sharif instead of Haram Sharif, even near Haram Sharif and the Dome of the Rock. Yes, so this is the tension that you clarify in the last chapter of your book that brings us again to think about the exceptionality of Israel, because it is there. It's the moment in which, when Sholem talks about the catastrophe inherent in the myth, he talks about that. It leads to that. It leads to the denial. And then you have to ask yourself, so, okay, what is the alternative? How can you propose a Jewish alternative, a Jewish Israeli alternative, which is based first on recognition of Palestinians as precondition to deal with messianism. I'm talking about it as a precondition for the discussion of the Jews, of the future of Israel that you raise.
So I think one of the interesting implications of this lacrimose view of Jewish history, or the view of Jewish history as a series of catastrophes that obviously culminate in the Nazi genocide, the Holocaust during the Second World War, and then brings about the establishment of what common parlance in Israel refers to as the Third Temple, entails much of the tensions of what we are discussing here. First of all, it's a temple that is considered to be secular. For some reason, this whole theological discussion, and then we say, but it's a secular construct. But then if you consider the precedents and you consider a history of destruction and catastrophes, and then you say, and we're sitting on top of this, again, volcano, trying to be normal, like, you obviously realize that there's something unsettling, and the continuous references to the imminent destruction, complete destruction of the polity, is a necessary conclusion of that kind of view. There's nothing normal in the Third Temple, even though the temple is built, the state as temple, right, is built in the name of normalizing the people. And I'm looking at the time, and I think maybe we should just make a, because this is the penultimate, and I just wanted to bring into the discussion that neglected and forgotten point of view that Leon Roth has bequeathed us of a Jewish critique of the state of Israel and of Zionism that is what's committed to Zionism. It is essentially fed by the Zionist impetus, is committed to Judaism, but it is also, I would say, unfortunately, unable to break away from the commitment to the nation state mindset.
The question whether it's necessary, and the question whether, yes, you left to Oxford and you tried to find perhaps Leon Ross. Leon Ross is an exceptional figure, I think. I don't know who knows about Leon Ross today, but for me, Leon Ross, I knew him as the translator of Hobbes' Leviathan.
Half the book.
And to realize only when I got the English version that it's not Hobbes' Leviathan. It's part of Hobbes' Leviathan, and as if Hobbes' Leviathan has no theological aspects. No, I mean, it's interesting that already there, at the Hebrew University, and this was the only translation, I still think I have a copy. We didn't understand anything because of the, you had to read it in English. So now we have a better translation of Nachum Lowerbaum, never mind. But it was impossible to understand it. You need explanation for the Hebrew,
yes,
of Leon Roth, who wanted to settle Hobbes in Israel, only the first two chapters. Only the first two chapters, which I think is fascinating. I mean, it's identical to Scholem's understanding of the volcano,
yes,
almost. Yes, if I continue,
yes,
translating,
yes,
if I continue translating, we really have to re-ask what is the state of Israel within this framework of discussion of sovereignty and the centralist state,
yes,
emerged by Hobbes. And then he leaves,
yeah,
like many others,
yeah,
who couldn't stand they fought for independence, never thought that the Brits will leave.
Yes.
Yes, I mean, that was too much for them, I think. And then they leave and they propose other Judaism. And they raise the questions of Zionism. I think that the last chapter is indeed,
yes,
Zionism from this interesting perspective. And Mike, I would ask you how Roth helps us now. For me, it was similar to, it's part of the discussion that takes now. You mentioned exile and diaspora. It is kind of a exchange between me and Daniel Boyarin, who wrote the book No State Option.
Yes.
There is a no state option, and you can say hallelujah, there is a no state option, but there is a state.
Yes,
yes, and you have to take responsibility for,
yes,
this state. And without any notion of responsibility,
yes,
to everything this state is doing, and this state is doing horrible things and leads itself, on my opinion, to its own destruction, and this is also the conclusion, I think, of Yaakov's book. I mean, it's a kind of anxiety that exists in all the pages of the book, attempt at normalizing it, and again, that's what I found all the time. It is the attempt of normalizing it. It is to say, listen, we have to analyze it within a general framework, and at the same time, when we do that, we open questions that cannot be raised,
yes,
in any other context, and in other, including immigrants from similar state, because as if did he went back to the Jewish community, the non-Zionist, or,
yes,
or again, he came a post-Zionist too. Yes. So
first of all, it's fascinating to think of Roth in light of the of Gershom Scholem's example, because they do emerge from the same time. They both established the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Roth left England in 1928. To establish the most Zionist thing to do at the time, to establish the philosophy department in the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. But, and like Scholem, he has deep and severe misgivings about the conduct of Zionist politics in Palestine and then later on after the establishment of the State of Israel. But unlike Sholem, he refuses to accept the position that, well, we need it since the Holocaust, we have to carry on with the real politics of the state. And this is where the responsibility comes into place. Leon Roth does not become an anti-Zionist Jew.
No, and he didn't even went to preach alone to support by nationalists.
Exactly. He was not. He would always be kind of a satellite member of these organizations, but never part of them. But he leaves Israel when it is already Israel. So after, just imagine that that ideological mindset. After the establishment of 1951, he leaves. He comes back to England. He doesn't leave much of a political doctrine to follow, but he does two important things once he leaves Israel. First, he sits down to write Jewish writings. The most, brilliant of which is Judaism, a Portrait. He takes upon himself to write a short book about what Judaism is all about, where he insists that it's Judaism, it's the teaching that makes the Jew and not the other way around. He speaks directly against this notion of being a chosen nation as being somehow elected and then better than other people. He insists that being a chosen nation means responsibility, duty, burden of the chosen. And this leads him to another kind of intervention of a Jewish critique of Israeli politics once they are in play. And I think with this, maybe I should end. I guess the only quote I would like to read from the book is a quote from his, I think, highly important letter to the Jewish Chronicle following the Kibya massacre, so a retaliatory military act of Israel against Palestinians in then Jordanian West Bank following an atrocity by Palestinians in Israel, where Roth reacts to the Board of Deputies' position that you can't critique Israel. It's double standard, they said, to criticize Israel. The president of the board wrote the JC and saying something to the effect, unless you are willing to commit that you would have never done anything like it yourself, right? You have no right to criticize Israel. Israel should be, again, don't exercise double standard. And Roth's intervention says, yes, we do demand double standards. We should stand up to higher moral standards because we're Jews. And he writes, to explain why he thinks so, the real tragedy is, of course, for the Israelis. And it does not lie in the political deterioration of their borders. It lies in the moral deterioration of their souls. What manner of men are these who could contrive this action? Of what persons could carry it out? Or what persons could carry it out, I'm sorry. And what manner of men are those who, arrogantly dismissing the moral issue, bemuse themselves and us with their realpolitik? Where terrorism is used as an instrument of policy, the worst consequences fall on those who use it. I think it's a powerful Jewish, committed Zionist critique of the State of Israel, which was obviously difficult to make from within Israel, but he was able to make it from outside.
It was
also
possible in Israel, you know,
yes.
Leibovitz.
Yes.
That you mentioned in the book.
Yes. And the comparison between Leibovitz's reaction to Kibya and Roth and others is highly illuminating.
We should open up for questions. We'll stop the
yes, please.
Recording.